Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Brexit podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and today joins me a very special guest, a head of Social Enterprise Saturday on October the 14th. Getting the plug in there early.
Thanks. Means I don't have to.
I've got the Social Enterprise UK's Deputy Chief Executive Officer, Nick Temple, with me, and we've actually come to Nick's HQ, Social Enterprise HQ. I wanted to start, just tell me a little bit about this building itself. Is quite an interesting backstory to this, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks Tim, and thanks for having me on. So this is London's oldest fire station, and when this was being redone on Tooley Street and London Bridge, we managed to persuade our corporate partners, PwC, to turn this into a bit of a centre for social enterprise. So we have our offices here. There's also an organisation called the School for Social Entrepreneurs that supports a load of startups. This is quite a dynamic movement, so there's lots of people starting up new social enterprises, and they do programmes and support for them. And then on the ground floor, we've got a great social enterprise restaurant called Brigade, which works to bring people coming out of homelessness and get them into the catering industry that's got, you know, currently 100% track record in doing so, and is a really inspiring place to have lunch. You get an enormous sense of well-being from every morsel of food and drink. And, you know, and that's why this movement and why social enterprise can be really exciting and inspiring. So we're lucky to be based here.
Yeah, you're kind of living the brand.
Absolutely. Living the dream, living the social enterprise brand every day.
You mentioned there about the number of startups. It's something I wanted to touch on early in the interview. You recently released a state of social enterprise survey. And in that, interesting figure that you found a quarter of social enterprises in the UK less than 3 years old. But the proportion of startups compared to some SMEs, small medium enterprises in general, the level of growth is sort of three times as much. So you really are, we are talking a growing sector here.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's, you know, partly it's, we've got quite a supportive kind of landscape in the UK. So there's kind of legal structure options, there's finance, there's some increasingly high profile examples. But also there's big trends that are pushing for this stuff, you know. I'm not a millennial, sadly. I'm a bit older, but you know, they're looking for purpose and meaning in their work increasingly. You know, actually, the job market looks a lot different, and there's lots of kind of startups and sole traders and self entrepreneurship going on. And obviously, there's lots more responsible business going on as well. So a bunch of these trends are moving in that direction, and yeah, it's really exciting. Like, we're seeing just new businesses pop up all the time, and you know, the people leading them look a bit different as well. That's the other exciting bit. So, you know, much higher proportions of female leadership in social enterprises, about 40% led by women. Still not good enough, but it's a lot better than their mainstream equivalents. And again, about 12% led by someone from Black, Asian, minority ethnic background. So they look different, they're operating differently, and yeah, it's exciting and dynamic.
And you talked about all the stuff there, I think you mentioned. But so for anyone who's to the uneducated, let's take it right back to brass tacks. What is, in a nutshell, a social enterprise?
So the one line version, which is what I use for my family, is it's a business that's trading for a social purpose. So that just means, in simple terms, that's written into its governing documents, it's written into its DNA, the social mission, the social purpose of what it's about. It makes profits like a business, it just does something different with them. So normally it's reinvesting those back into the social mission, or it's giving them away. So I've got a bottle of water in front of me on the desk, which obviously doesn't work in audio terms, but Belu Water, they're a bottled water brand. They operate like a bottled water brand, but they give all 100% of their profits away to WaterAid. So, you know, they're businesses, but they're set up to deliver a social purpose. That's the key difference.
Yeah, and I've been doing some writing about this recently, and some of these businesses are quite ingenious in the way that they go about things. Now, I was at a recent event of yours, and can you just give me a couple of the examples of some of perhaps the more creative businesses, I would say, you know, in terms
yeah,
of
sure. So there's a really wide range. So, you know, everything from, you know, we've got a company called Soap Co, who, you know, they make toiletry products and kind of hand wash and all that kind of stuff, but their employment and their workforce are people who are visually impaired or have other disabilities, you know, giving them an opportunity, giving them a chance, getting them back into employment. You know, there's ones like Stand for Socks, who for every pair of socks you buy, they'll put the profits or give those away to people who need them in different countries. There's, you know, there's a whole range of products. There's, I'm looking up at the shelf behind us in the office as well. There's a football there which is made, you know, they're called Alive and Kicking, great social enterprise. Football's made in Africa, they're fair trade footballs, and again, the profits recycle to help the communities where they operate and where they're made.
And
in
netballs
Africa.
Too, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. They're not, they don't differentiate. So there's a really wide range. And then there's bigger ones as well. So, you know, HCT Group are a big bus company. You know, people getting the red bus out in East London here might not know that, or indeed across Jersey where they operate all the buses. But every penny of profit that they're making from those commercial bus routes is reinvested back into helping the elderly to get around, community transport, training for people who need it to use transport, and a range of other community initiatives. So really interesting range of models, and just connected, like I say, by having that social mission, having that purpose, but using profits in a different way and being a business.
Now, I'm sure, like all of us and like all of the listeners, you've been following the events of Brexit over the past year and a bit now. And is it been a case of, have you been able to get involved, have your voice heard? Is there a message you want to get out there, or are you just kind of watching on and thinking, what the hell's going to happen next?
There's a bit of watching on, but we have raised our voice as well. I mean, it's the social sector, which I didn't, you know, talk about charities and social enterprises, sometimes struggles to get its voice heard, despite being a pretty big employer and a big part of the British economy. I think, you know, often the debates at the moment, and arguably currently politically, it's even worse, you know, tends to be privatisation versus nationalisation. I suppose our take is, hey guys, there's a bunch of really interesting models in between that take the best of business and maybe the best of the kind of public benefit and social mission.
Yeah.
So that gets lost a bit. Certainly we've been trying to raise our voice because Brexit is going to affect social enterprises as much as other parts of the economy. You know, whether that's in terms of 15 to 20% export, you know, where the workforce comes from, how procurement and commissioning works for them in the public sector. There's a wide range of issues, and Brexit is certainly rising up in terms of those challenges, and particularly in the areas that have benefited most, arguably, from some of the European funding that comes back as well. So there's a range of issues. Are we getting our voice heard? I'm not sure anyone's getting their voice heard fully at the moment, but I think we're probably struggling to break through on top of the kind of more standard business interests as well.
Okay, let's go into a couple of those areas specifically. Now, you mentioned funding there and European money, EU funding that comes through. So does a social enterprise need funding, first off? Because to my understanding, the business model is meant to be there for it to be sustainable. So does it need funding? If so, then okay. And where does that money currently come from? And then, therefore, is there a threat to that when we leave the EU?
Yeah, sure. So they trade. So, you know, three quarters of them get more than three quarters of their money from trading. The European money that flows back is sometimes through contracts. So often they're having to bid competitively for some of that income. I guess it's worth saying in passing that the private sector gets quite a few grants as well. Like, we always think about the social sector being propped up, but, you know, you could argue banks and farming and some big factories have had much bigger grant and subsidy from government than the charity sector.
High profile ones over the past decade.
You know, so sometimes we're a bit kind of hard on ourselves, I think. But I suppose what's interesting about the money that does flow back is it tends to be allocated to the places in the country that need it most. So it's quite redistributive, weirdly, which... So there's, from our perspective, you know, there's a benefit to that European money being decided, you know, actually they prioritise regionally and locally, where does that go, what do they need to do in that area, and yeah, it's not just social enterprises that benefit from that, you know, even the conference centre that I was at in Manchester at the Tory party conference last week, you know, that was built with European money and investment, so irony alert. So there's a bunch of money that flows into those areas. The really interesting thing about that is those areas, the ones often with the most need, the most disadvantage on all the kind of various statistics, are often the ones that voted most heavily to leave and potentially the ones to most suffer from the withdrawal of that funding and income. So that's a real kind of, I don't know if it's ironic or whether it's just going to be a really big challenge. And government will have to decide, will it put the same amount of money into those areas that it has historically in this way, because that's going to be a key decision in those areas that are struggling, where public sector money is most important, where, you know, actually it's difficult to sustain a kind of a market-based economy at the moment.
And it's not just the funding per se, is it? In those areas there, from your report, actually a lot of social enterprises set up, deliberately set up in deprived areas all around the country. I think you had some facts and figures on that in the report.
Yeah.
So therefore, if those areas struggle, become less prosperous, then that would have a knock-on effect even to, let's say, an unfunded social enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, so about a third, I mean, it's about 28% of social enterprises operate in the most deprived areas, the sort of top 20% most deprived areas. So they're deliberately trying to tackle, you know, employment, cohesion, community improvement problems in the areas where they're needed most. And I think, yeah, some of those in various routes are benefiting from some of the European investment that's going on, and they will struggle because, you know, they tend to be the areas also where local authorities are having to cut quite a bit. You know, big industry or other corporates might have left and so on. So, you know, how do you make kind of markets work where, you know, the markets are a bit broken? That's a real challenge, actually. So, you know, they're trying to do that. They're trying to find ways to do that. They're pretty resilient, is what our report would say. They're diversifying as well. So they're trying to, you know, buy buildings. They're trying to sell to the public. They're trying to work with big business much more as well, getting their supply chains. Mm. So they're trying to diversify. But there will be a real challenge, I think, in terms of some of that money being withdrawn.
Mm. It's not all bad news, though. We spoke briefly before the interview about procurement, as you mentioned, is a topic that actually there could be some good that comes out of Brexit.
Yes, I mean, procurement's not always a topic to send a pulse racing, Tim, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, very simply, you know, we spend, you know, $300 to $400 billion in the public sector every year. Our take is, how do we spend that in a way that delivers social and environmental value, not just purely the cheapest price, because that's a kind of race to the bottom. And so the Social Value Act, which we introduced, is something that tries to encourage local authorities and other bits of the public sector to do this sensibly. And often they will say that European regulations are a barrier, that it kind of restricts them in some way. So we often kind of hear, can't do that, sort of EU rules, mate, sorry.
Okay.
Now, obviously, you know, for a while we've kind of said, well, actually, that's not strictly true. But obviously, in a couple of years, we'll be able to say, well, you know, you can't really use that excuse anymore.
No.
More positively, actually, the government could decide, let's use this as an opportunity to really think about how we use procurement to deliver the outcomes we want to see. Take Port Talbot in Wales. You know, if the entirety of the kind of social value of that steelworks had been considered, the community benefit, you know, the employment benefit, the recycled money going into that community had been considered in that procurement, then it's much more likely that they would have been able to keep going, and they would have been, you know, we would also be encouraging manufacturers to spend on British steel because there would be a social value requirement within those kind of tenders. So it's real opportunities to kind of think proactively about how do we use the money we already spend and are going to spend in a way that benefits the communities and the people across the country. And that's, for me, that's a big opportunity. There are real challenges with Brexit, but for me, that's one of the big opportunities.
Yeah, and I guess given that topic there that you just talked about in terms of helping Port Talbot, and it is Social Enterprise UK. Now, but the values of a social enterprise would be to help people that are struggling or who are deprived. But does that extend, does your remit extend beyond these shores? Because that's quite a key point when we come to Brexit. You know, are we going to be inclusive or are we going to be perhaps more protectionist?
So we're doing a growing amount of international work. This is an international movement. There's no doubt about that. The reason why you're hearing from me and not my boss is because he's been in New Zealand at the Social Enterprise World Forum, you know, with 1,500 people from across the world. So there's no doubt this is a global movement. And the UK is actually seen as a leader on social enterprise. It's really a kind of global leader. Also, as I said earlier, like 15 to 20% of our members export. They're operating internationally already, so this stuff affects them in the way that it affects other businesses. Obviously, we're called Social Enterprise UK, so our primary focus is the UK.
Yeah.
But we do have to think of those international connections as well, both for our members and for ourselves. I mean, I think there are going to be enough issues within the UK probably to keep us busy. So it's not the biggest part of our business as an organisation. But yeah, this is a global movement. This is one where, you know, the same trends I talked about at the start, they're helping grow social enterprise in the UK, they're the same trends that are happening across the world. And I think from our perspective, you know, probably the most above and beyond the technical bits of Brexit, I think the most worrying bit is that it makes us look quite insular, and the perception that gives to the world. Like, we've been doing work in Greece, Morocco, Sri Lanka recently, and, you know, amongst the first questions is, you know, how's Brexit going?
Yes.
You know, what does that mean? And that's, that can be damaging. That can be, you know, the perception of Britain has definitely changed a bit, I think, by the vote as well.
So workforce, maybe flipping back to a slightly negative, because you were mentioned again prior to the interview that there are going to be workforce concerns now for social enterprises, with potentially the free movement of people may come to an end, and then, so what happens next? So, yeah, your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's good news and bad news. So, like, I think, you know, from the bad news perspective, I'll try and start there and go optimistic as I go on. Certainly a lot of the bigger social enterprises operating, for example, health and social care, you know, they have similar workforce concerns to a lot of the big healthcare employers, both in the public and private sector. Social enterprises will tend, you know, about 78% already pay the living wage. They'll tend to be, through who they are and what they're about, be treating their employees pretty well. In many cases, they're giving their employees a stake. They're an owner of the social enterprise as well. So that leads to often better productivity and so on. And they know that, you know, that any money that's made isn't going to, I don't know, make one bloke richer and be able to drive a Porsche, but is actually being reinvested back into the mission. And sometimes that means in difficult industries, they can, you know, tight margins they can operate on in a way that maybe a normal for-profit for dividend company wouldn't be able to. But they've got big workforce challenges, and they're raising that with us. You know, a lot of them will be using staff from across Eastern Europe and more broadly. And, you know, although they're all investing in apprenticeships and employee development and talent pipelines and thinking through their recruitment strategies right now, there's no doubt there's going to be big challenges ahead. And, you know, that's certainly one of the big ones we're raising with government and also trying to address with them locally as well.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to go into politics slightly. And, and who are you raising it with in government?
Sure.
Who are you going to?
Yeah.
And the political landscape seems to be changing somewhat at the moment. We've got the Tory party conference on at the moment.
Yeah.
And now you look from an outside, it looks like they're pinching some of the Labour policies, because the power of Jeremy Corbyn is having an influence. And, you know, there was an announcement today on more council houses. So, over to you.
It's been interesting. So I've just been, you know, I'm just coming fresh from Brighton and Manchester.
Right.
So, you know, and to be honest, at Brighton, I felt quite old, and at Manchester, I felt quite young. it's been very interesting. I mean, I think, you know, look, Labour's got some connections to this movement. You know, it's a lot of Labour MPs are also cooperative party MPs, co-ops, you know, the vast majority are social enterprises. So, you know, there's real connections there. But equally, there's this, as I said earlier, there's this kind of strong move towards, you know, back to the public sector, back to nationalisation. And again, that's not necessarily something the social enterprise movement would agree with.
Sure.
Equally on the kind of, you're very right, I think, in your characterisation of the Tory conference. It was really interesting. There's a real, from our perspective, I think there's a real paucity of ideas. It felt very reactive to the agenda being set by the Labour conference, and a lot of soul searching and, as you know, kind of internal sort of fighting.
Yeah.
It doesn't need me to document any more than it already has been. You know, there were a few events where I was starting to hear those, I guess, on the more centre of the Tory party, starting to generate new ideas, people like George Freeman, starting to kind of come up with new ways of thinking and seeing social enterprises and mutuals as part of that. And I think they have to, because, you know, actually, you know, the reality, as they said, is, you know, certainly from a younger generation perspective, you know, pure free market capitalism doesn't work if you haven't got any capital at a very fundamental level. So actually, they've got to address how that's working. You know, the free market isn't working for those people, not in housing, not in their jobs, not in their pensions, you know. And how they achieve that against the backdrop of Brexit, I think, is really, really challenging. You know, but at the same time, I think, you know, Labour does seem to be going, you know, backward a bit to nationalisation. And I think we think there's some options in the middle that are really interesting. You know, take utilities. The data would say a lot of the country want utilities to kind of come back into public ownership. Our take is that doesn't necessarily have to mean they're nationalised. You know, Welsh Water is a company limited by guarantee. It's owned by, you know, no one. It's not owned by shareholders. It's owned by their staff and their employees. And it's got, you know, the best reinvestment rates, the lowest complaints, and so on and so forth. That's because it's not in the public sector. It's not part of the state. But also it's not, you know, it's not owned by an Australian bank. We're in Thames Water territory. Okay. You know, so
yeah.
So there are these options that we could have. There's no reason if buses can be run by social enterprise in London, why can't the next train franchise be run by a social enterprise
right.
that reinvests profits and is owned by employees and the communities it works in? We've got to think of it differently. So that's the stuff we were trying to take to the conference. You know, how well received? I think some of them get it. We've got a way to go with some of the others. I think okay. I'm being diplomatic at that point. Yeah.
Well, Southern Rail, one of the most loved train franchises. So that's going to be run by social enterprise.
Well, I would love to. I mean, you know, like how much worse could it get? To be honest, you know. So I think, you know, we'd be pretty confident now. You know, GLL is one of our members. They're a 300 million turnover business. These, you know, there are social enterprises that are very small. We've got, you know, there's like business, there's a lot of small and medium social enterprises, but there's some biggies too. You know, the bus company I mentioned, ACT, they're 50, looking at 100 million. You know, they can run big organisations now. We have the capacity to do that. And they've got to think differently about how their stuff could work. And I think, yeah, train franchises would be a great place to start and signal there's a different way of doing things. From our perspective, I don't really mind which party comes to the table with that. We just think it should be more spoken about as an option, because otherwise we're in this kind of quite 70s, 80s sort of privatise or nationalise debate. And actually what we're seeing, particularly from the younger generations, is they get that there's some interesting stuff in the middle.
Yeah.
Businesses can be combined with a social impact and can do things differently. So why are the parties not representing that at the moment?
Okay. And then just finally, really, I guess, but you do have some big supporters. I know Michael Sheen, the actor, star of Frost Nixon, he's a bit of a fan of social enterprises. He was on one of your adverts recently.
Yeah, Michael Sheen's been great. I mean, he gets it, right? So he's I mean, he hasn't given up acting, but he's been giving more of his time to kind of activism and trying to get involved. And this resonated with him. I think, you know, Port Talbot and stuff like that, it's his neck of the woods. You know, he understands the potential of some of this stuff. He's obviously, from our perspective, got a pretty amazing address book. And frankly, is a bit more articulate than me, and a bit more charismatic when he's talking about this stuff.
So, I think you're doing very well.
You know, so you know, well, you know, but so yeah. So again, from our perspective, I suppose, you know, we've talked about the private sector and public sector. A lot of social enterprises are bought by the likes of you and me as individuals. You know, the chocolate, the water, the socks, the, you know, the olive oil, the toiletries we buy. We can make a difference with every purchase we make, and so cutting through to that consumer awareness as well. And people like Michael Sheen, Chris Addison, who's been on the thick of it and so on, is really helping us as well. You know, actually, they can really help us in terms of getting to those markets, because they've got reach that would take us, it's fair to say, a while to build up. So, yeah, he's our patron, and we're looking forward to hopefully doing more with him and more films with him to try and crack the consumer market and raise awareness further as well.
Okay. So, but for now, let's use the reach of the Brexit podcast.
Yes.
So what can people do to get involved? You've got a bit of an event coming up.
Yeah, so Social Saturday coming up on October the 14th. You know, it's a day when loads of social enterprises across the country are opening their doors. You can buy from a social enterprise. You can find that also via our website at socialenterprise.org.uk. Big Issue, who are a big partner of ours, they'll have a Social Saturday store where you can buy stuff. So have a look, see what's available. We think you'll be surprised at the range of social enterprises there are. Buy something that day and make a difference to your local community and to your local social enterprise as well.
Terrific. Nick, thank you ever so much for joining us today on the Brexit podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
The Brexit podcast was brought to you by Jennifer Harm, Warren Pohl, Ollie Dugmore and myself, Tim Hemming. Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod, and see you next time. And the Brexit podcast was brought to you by Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl, Ollie Dugmore, and myself, Tim Hemming. Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod. And see you next time.